Parnell Air National Guard Base, Tennessee. Gavin Blair escorts me to the office of his squadron commander, Colonel Christina Eliopoulos. As much a legend for her temper as for her outstanding war record, it is difficult to see how so much intensity can be compacted into her diminutive, almost childlike frame. Her long black bangs and delicate facial features only reinforce the picture of eternal youth. Then she removes her sunglasses, and I see the fire behind her eyes. I was a Raptor driver. The FA-22. It was hands down the best air superiority platform ever built. It could outfly and outfight God and all his angels. It was a monument to American technical prowess, and in this war, that prowess counted for shit. That must have been frustrating. Frustrating? Do you know what it feels like to suddenly be told that the one goal you've worked toward all your life, that you've sacrificed and suffered for, that's pushed you beyond limits you never knew you had, is now considered strategically invalid? Would you say this was a common feeling? Let me put it this way. The Russian army wasn't the only service to be decimated by their own government. The Armed Forces Reconstruction Act basically neutered the Air Force. Some dest res experts had determined that our resource-to-kill ratio, our RKR, was the most lopsided of all the branches. Could you give me some example? How about the JSOW, the Joint Standoff Weapon? It was a gravity bomb guided by GPS and inertial nav that could be released from as far as 40 miles away. The baseline version carried 140 BLU-97B submunitions, and each bomblet carried a shaped charge against armored targets, a fragmented case against infantry, and a zirconium ring to set the entire kill zone ablaze. It had been considered a triumph until Yonkers. Note 1. Joint standoff weapons were used in concert with a variety of other air-launched ordnance at Yonkers. End note. Now we were told that the price of one JSOW kit, the materials, manpower, time, and energy, not to mention the fuel and ground maintenance needed for the delivery aircraft, could pay for a platoon of infantry pukes who could smoke 1,000 times as many G's. Not enough bang for our buck, like so many of our former crown jewels. They went through us like an industrial laser. The B-2 Spirits, gone. The B-1 Lancers, gone. Even the old Buffs. The B-52 Big Ugly Fat Fellows, gone. Throw in the Eagles, the Falcons, the Tomcats, Hornets, JSFs, and Raptors, and you have more combat aircraft lost to the stroke of a pen than to all the SAMs, FLAC, and enemy fighters in history. Note 2. A slight exaggeration. The amount of combat aircraft grounded during World War Z does not equal those lost during World War II. End note. At least the assets weren't scrapped, thank God. Just mothballed in warehouses, or that big desert graveyard at AMARC. Note 3. AMARC, Aerospace Maintenance and Regeneration Center, outside of Tucson, Arizona. End note. Long-term investment, they called it. That's the one thing you can always depend on. As we're fighting one war, we're always preparing for the next one. Our airlift capacity, at least the organization, was almost left intact. Almost. The Globemasters had to go. So did anything else powered by a gas-guzzling jet. That left us with prop-powered aircraft. I went from flying the closest thing to an X-wing fighter to the next best thing to a U-Haul. Was that the main mission of the Air Force? Airborne resupply was our primary objective, the only one that really counted anymore. She points to a yellowed map on the wall. The base commander let me keep it after what happened to me. The map is of the wartime continental United States. All land west of the Rockies is shadowed a light gray. Amongst this gray are a variety of colored circles. Islands in the Sea of Zack. Green denotes active military facilities. Some of them had been converted into refugee centers. Some were still contributing to the war effort. Some were well defended, but had no strategic impact. The red zones were labeled offensively viable. Factories, mines, power plants. The Army'd left custodial teams during the big pullback. Their job was to guard and maintain these facilities for a time when, if, we could add them to the overall war effort. The blue zones were civilian areas where people had managed to make a stand, carve out a little piece of real estate, and figure some way to live within its boundaries. All these zones were in need of resupply, and that's what the Continental Airlift was all about. It was a massive operation, not just in terms of aircraft and fuel, but organization as well. Remaining in contact with all these islands, processing their demands, coordinating with Dest Res, then trying to procure and prioritize all the materiel for each drop, made it the statistically largest undertaking in Air Force history. We tried to stay away from consumables, things like food and medicine that required regular deliveries. These were classified as DDs, dependency drops. And they got a back seat to SSDs, self-sustaining drops, like tools, spare parts, and tools to make spare parts. "They don't need fish," Sinclair used to say. "They need fishing poles." Still, every autumn we dropped a lot of fish and wheat and salt and dried vegetables and baby formula. Winters were hard. Remember how long they used to be? Helping people to help themselves is great in theory, but you still got to keep them alive. Sometimes you had to drop in people, specialists like doctors or engineers, people with the kind of training you just can't get from a how-to manual. The Blue Zones got a lot of special forces instructors, not only to teach them how better to defend themselves, but to prepare them for the day they might have to go on the offensive. I have a lot of respect for those guys. Most of them knew it was for the duration. A lot of the Blue Zones didn't have airstrips, so they had to parachute in without any hope of pickup. Not all those Blue Zones remained secure. Some were eventually overrun. The people we dropped in knew the risks they were taking. A lot of hard, all of them. That goes for the pilots as well. Hey, I'm not minimizing our risks at all. Every day we had to fly over hundreds, in some cases thousands of miles of infested territory. That's why we had purple zones. She refers to the last color on the map. The purple circles are few and far between. We set these up as refuel and repair facilities. A lot of the aircraft didn't have the range to reach remote drop zones on the East Coast if in-flight refueling assets weren't available. They helped reduce the number of ships and crews lost en route. They brought our fleet's survivability up to 92%. Unfortunately, I was part of the other 8. I'll never be sure what exactly brought us down, mechanical malfunction or metal fatigue combined with weather. It might have been the contents of our payload, mislabeled or mishandled. That happened a lot more than anyone wanted to think about. Sometimes, if hazardous materials weren't packaged properly, or, God forbid, some shit-for-brains QC inspector let his people assemble their detonators before crating them for travel. That happened to a buddy of mine, just a routine flight from Palmdale to Vandenberg, not even across an infested area. 200 Type 38 detonators, all fully assembled with their power cells accidentally running, all set to blow on the same freak as our radio. She snaps her fingers. That could have been us. We were on a hop from Phoenix to the Blue Zone outside Tallahassee, Florida. It was late October, almost full winter back then. Honolulu was trying to squeeze out just a few more drops before the weather socked us in until March. It was our 9th haul that week. We were all on tweaks. These little blue stems that kept you going without hampering your reflexes or judgment. I guess they worked well enough, but they made me have to piss my kidneys out every 20 minutes. My crew, the guys, Used to give me a lot of grief, you know, girls always having to go. I know they weren't really putting the hate on, but I still tried to hold it as long as I could. After 2 hours of banging around in some seriously heavy turbulence, I finally broke down and turned the stick over to my co-pilot. I'd just zipped up when suddenly there was this massive jolt, like God had just drop-kicked our tail, and suddenly our nose was dipping. The head on our C-130 wasn't even really a toilet, just a portable chem pod with a heavy plastic shower curtain. That's probably what ended up saving my life. If I'd been trapped in a real compartment, maybe knocked out or unable to reach the latch. Suddenly there was this screech, this overpowering blast of high-pressure air, and I was sucked out right through the rear of the aircraft, right past where the tail should have been. I was spiraling out of control. I could just make out my ship, this gray mass shrinking and smoking on its way down. I straightened myself out, hit my chute. I was still in a daze, my head swimming, trying to catch my breath. I fumbled for my radio and started hollering for my crew to punch out. I didn't get an answer. All I could see was one other chute, the only other one that made it out. That was the worst moment right there, just hanging helplessly. I could see the other chute, above and north of me by about 3.5 clicks. I looked for the others. I tried my radio again, but wasn't able to get a signal. I figured it had been damaged during my exit. I tried to get my bearings somewhere over southern Louisiana, a swampy wilderness that seemed to have no end. I wasn't sure exactly. My brain was still misfiring. At least I had sense enough to check the bare essentials. I could move my legs, my arms. I wasn't in pain or bleeding externally. I'd checked to make sure my survival kit was intact, still strapped to my thigh, and that my weapon, my Meg, was still jamming me in the ribs. Note 4. Meg. The pilot's nickname for their standard-issue 22 automatic pistol. It is suspected that the appearance of the weapon, its extended suppressor, folding stock, and telescopic sight give it the appearance of the old Hasbro Transformers toy, Megatron. This fact has yet to be confirmed. End note. Did the Air Force prepare you for situations like these? We all had to pass the Willow Creek Escape and Evade program in the Klamath Mountains in California. It even had a few real G's in there with us, tagged and tracked and placed at specific marks to give us the real feel. It's a lot like what they teach you in the civilian manual. Movement, stealth, how to take out Zack before he can howl your position. We all made it. Lived, I mean. Although a couple of pilots washed out on a Section 8. I guess they just couldn't hack the real feel. That never bothered me, being alone in hostile territory. That was standard operating procedure for me. Always. You want to talk about being alone in a hostile environment? Try my 4 years at Colorado Springs. But there were other women, other cadets, other competitors who happened to have the same genitalia. Trust me, when the pressure kicked in, sisterhood punched out. No, it was me, only me. Self-contained, self-reliant, and always unquestionably self-assured. That's the only thing that got me through 4 years of academy hell, and it was the only thing I could count on as I hit the mud in the middle of G country. I unclasped my chute. They'd teach you not to waste time concealing it, and headed in the direction of the other chute. It took me a couple hours, splashing through this cold slime that numbed everything below my knees. I wasn't thinking, clearly. My head was still spinning. No excuse, I know, but that's why I didn't notice that the birds had suddenly beat it in the opposite direction. I did hear the scream, though, faint and far away. I could see the chute tangled in the trees. I started running. Another no-no, making all that noise without stopping to listen for Zack. I couldn't see anything. Just all these naked gray branches until they were right on top of me. If it wasn't for Rollins, my co-pilot, I'm sure I'd have been a goner. I found him dangling from his harness, dead, twitching. His flight suit had been torn open, and his entrails were hanging, draped over five of them as they fed in this cloud of red-brown water. Note 5. At this point in the war, the new battle dress uniforms, BDUs, were not in mass production. End note. One of them had managed to get its neck entangled in a section of small intestine. Every time it moved, it would jerk Rollins, ringing him like a fucking bell. They didn't notice me at all. Close enough to touch, and they didn't even look. At least I had the brains to snap on my suppressor. I didn't have to waste a whole clip. Another fuck-up. I was so angry I almost started kicking their corpses. I was so ashamed, so blinded by self-hate. Self-hate. I screwed the pooch. My ship, my crew. But it was an accident. It wasn't your fault.
How do you know that? You weren't there. Shit, I wasn't even there. I don't know what happened. I wasn't doing my job. I was squatting over a bucket like a goddamn girl. I found myself burning up mentally. Fucking weakling, I told myself. Fucking loser. I started to spiral. Not just hating myself, but hating myself for hating myself. Does that make any sense? I'm sure I might have just stayed there, shaking and helpless and waiting for Zack. But then my radio started squawking. Hello, hello, is anyone out there? Anyone punch out of that wreck? It was a woman's voice, clearly civilian by her language and tone. I answered immediately, identified myself, and demanded that she respond in kind. She told me she was a Skywatcher, and her handle was Metz Fan, or just Metz for short. The Skywatch system was this ad hoc network of isolated ham radio operators. They were supposed to report on downed air crews and do what they could to help with their rescue. It wasn't the most efficient system, mainly because there were so few, but it looked like today was my lucky day. She told me that she had seen the smoke and falling wreckage of my Herc, and even though she was probably less than a day's walk from my position, her cabin was heavily surrounded. Before I could say anything, she told me not to worry, that she'd already reported my position to search and rescue, and the best thing to do was to get to open ground where I could rendezvous for pickup. I reached for my GPS, but it had been torn from my suit when I was sucked out of my ship. I had a backup survival map, but it was so big, so unspecific, and my hump took me over so many states that it was practically just a map of the U.S. My head was still clouded with anger and doubt. I told her I didn't know my position. Didn't know where to go. She laughed. You mean you've never made this run before? You don't have every inch of it committed to memory? You didn't see where you were as you were hanging by the silk? She was so sure of me, trying to get me to think instead of just spoon-feeding me the answers. I realized that I did know this area well, that I had flown over it at least 20 times in the last 3 months, and that I had to be somewhere in the Atchafalaya Basin. Think, she told me, what did you see from your chute? Were there any rivers, any roads? At first, all I could remember were the trees, the endless gray landscape, with no distinguishable features. And then gradually, as my brain cleared, I remembered seeing both rivers and a road. I checked on the map and realized that directly north of me was the I-10 freeway. Metz told me that was the best place for an S&R pickup. She told me it shouldn't take any longer than a day or two at best if I got a move on and stopped burning daylight. As I was about to leave, she stopped me and asked if there was anything I'd forgotten to do. I remember that moment clearly. I turned back to Rollins. He was just starting to open his eyes again. I felt like I should say something, apologize maybe. Then I put a round through his forehead. Metz told me not to blame myself, and no matter what, not to let it distract me from the job I had to do. She said, "Stay alive. Stay alive and do your job." Then she added, "And stop using up your weekend minutes." She was talking about battery power. She didn't miss a trick. So I signed off and started moving north across the swamp. My brain was now on full burner. All my lessons from the creek came rolling back. I stepped, I halted, I listened. I stuck to dry ground where I could, and I made sure to pace myself very carefully. I had to swim a couple times. That really made me nervous. Twice I swear I could feel a hand just brush against my leg. Once I found a road, small, barely two lanes, and in horrible disrepair. Still, it was better than trudging through the mud. I reported to Metz what I'd found and asked if it would take me right to the freeway. She warned me to stay off it and every other road that crisscrossed the basin. "Roads mean cars," she said, "and cars mean G's." She was talking about any bitten human drivers who died of their wounds while still behind the wheel. And because a ghoul doesn't have the IQ points to open a door or unbuckle a seatbelt, would be doomed to spend the rest of their existence trapped in their cars. I asked her what the danger of that was, since they couldn't get out, and as long as I didn't let them reach through an open window to grab me, what did it matter how many abandoned cars I passed along the road? Metz reminded me that a trapped G was still able to moan, and therefore still able to call for others. Now I was really confused. If I was going to waste so much time ducking a few back roads with a couple Zach-filled cars, why was I heading for a freeway that was sure to be jammed with them? She said, "You'll be up above the swamp. How are more zombies going to get to you?" Because it was built several stories above the swamp, this section of the I-10 was the safest place in the whole basin. I confessed I hadn't thought of that. She laughed and said, "Don't worry, honey. I have. Stick with me and I'll get you home." And I did. I stayed away from anything even resembling a road and stuck to as pure a wilderness track as I could. I say pure, but the truth was, you couldn't avoid all signs of humanity, or what could have been humanity a long time ago. There were shoes, clothes, bits of garbage, and tattered suitcases and hiking gear. I saw a lot of bones on the patches of raised mud. I couldn't tell if they were human or animal. One time I found this rib cage. I'm guessing it was a gator, a big one. I didn't want to think about how many G's it took to bring that bastard down. The first G I saw was small, probably a kid. I couldn't tell. Its face was eaten off. The skin, nose, eyes, lips, even the hair and ears. Not completely gone, but partially hanging or stuck in patches to the exposed skull. Maybe there were more wounds, I couldn't tell. It was stuck inside one of those long civilian hiker's packs, stuffed in there tight, with the drawstring pulled right up around its neck. The shoulder straps had gotten tangled on the roots of a tree. It was splashing around, half-submerged. Its brain must have been intact, and even some of the muscle fibers connecting the jaw. That jaw started snapping as I approached. I don't know how it knew I was there. Maybe some of the nasal cavity was still intact. Maybe the ear canal. It couldn't moan. Its throat had been too badly mangled. But the splashing might have attracted attention. So I put it out of its misery, if it really was miserable, and tried not to think about it. That was another thing they taught us at Willow Creek. Don't write their eulogy. Don't try to imagine who they used to be, how they came to be here, how they came to be this. I know. Who doesn't do that, right? Who doesn't look at one of those things and just naturally start to wonder? It's like reading the last page of a book, your imagination just naturally spinning. And that's when you get distracted, get sloppy, let your guard down, and end up leaving someone else to wonder what happened to you. I tried to put it out of my mind. Instead, I found myself wondering why it had been the only one I'd seen. That was a practical survival question, not just idle musings, so I got on the radio and asked Metz if there was something I was missing here. if maybe there was some area I should be careful to avoid. She reminded me that this area was, for the most part, depopulated, because the blue zones of Baton Rouge and Lafayette were pulling most of the G's in either direction. That was bittersweet comfort, being right between two of the heaviest clusters for miles. She laughed again. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. I saw something up ahead, a lump that was almost a thicket, but too boxy and shining in places. I reported it to Metz. She warned me not to go near it, keep on going, and keep my eyes on the prize. I was feeling pretty good by this point, a little of the old me coming back. As I got closer, I could see that it was a vehicle, a Lexus hybrid SUV. It was covered in mud and moss and sitting in the water up to its doors. I could see that the rear windows were blocked with survival gear, tent, sleeping bag, cooking utensils, hunting rifle with boxes and boxes of shells, all new, some still in their plastic. I came around the driver's side window and caught the glint of a .357. It was still clutched in the driver's brown, shriveled hand. He was still sitting upright, looking straight ahead. There was light coming through the side of his skull. He was badly decomposed, at least a year, maybe more. He wore survival khakis, the kind you'd order from one of those upscale hunting safari catalogs. They were still clean and crisp. The only blood was from the head wound. I couldn't see any other wound, no bites, nothing. That hit me hard, a lot harder than the little faceless kid. This guy had had everything he needed to survive, everything except the will. I know that supposition. Maybe there was a wound I couldn't see, hidden by his clothes or the advanced decomposition. But I knew it, leaning there with my face against the glass, looking at this monument to how easy it was to give up. I stood there for a moment, long enough for Metz to ask me what was happening. I told her what I was seeing, and without pause, she told me to keep on going. I started to argue. I thought I should at least search the vehicle, see if there was anything I needed. She asked me sternly if there was anything I needed, not wanted. I thought about it, admitted there wasn't. His gear was plentiful, but it was civilian, big and bulky. The food needed cooking. The weapons weren't silenced. My survival kit was pretty thorough, and if for some reason I didn't find a helo waiting at the I-10, I could always use this as an emergency supply cache. I brought up the idea of maybe using the SUV itself. Metz asked if I had a tow truck and some jumper cables. Almost like a kid, I answered no. She asked, "Then what's keeping you?" or something like that, pushing me to get a move on. I told her to just wait a minute. I leaned my head against the driver's side window. I sighed and felt beat again, drained. Metz got on my ass, pushing me. I snapped back for her to shut the fuck up. I just needed a minute, a couple seconds to, I don't know what. I must have kept my thumb on the transmit button for a few seconds too long, because Matt suddenly asked, "What was that?" "What?" I asked. She'd heard something, something on my end.
"She'd heard it before you?"
"I guess so, because in another second, once I'd cleared my head and opened my ears, I began to hear it too. The moan, loud and close, followed by the splashing of feet. I looked up through the car's window, the hole in the dead man's skull, and the window on the other side, and that's when I saw the first one. I spun around and saw five more coming at me from all directions, and behind them were another 10, 15. I took a shot at the first one. The round went wild. Metz started squawking at me, demanding a contact report. I gave her a head count, and she told me to stay cool. Don't try to run, just stay put and follow what I'd learned at Willow Creek. I started to ask how she knew about Willow Creek when she shouted for me to shut up and fight. I climbed to the top of the SUV, you're supposed to look for the closest physical defense, and started to measure ranges. I lined up my first target, took a deep breath, and dropped him. To be a fighter jock is to be able to make decisions as fast as your electrochemical impulses can carry them. I'd lost that nanosecond timing when I hit the mud. Now it was back. I was calm, I was focused. All the doubt and weakness were gone. The whole engagement felt like 10 hours, but I guess in reality it was more like 10 minutes. 61 in total. A nice thick ring of submerged corpses. I took my time, checked my remaining ammo, and waited for the next wave to come. None did. It was another 20 minutes before Metz asked me for an update. I gave her a body count, and she told me to remind her never to piss me off. I laughed, the first time since I'd hit the mud. I felt good again, strong and confident. Metz warned me that all these distractions had erased any chance of making it to the I-10 before nightfall, and that I should probably start thinking about where I was going to catch my 40. I got as far away from the SUV as I could before the sky started to darken, and found a decent enough perch in the branches of a tall tree. My kit had this standard-issue microfiber hammock. Great invention, light and strong, with clasps to keep you from rolling out. That part was also supposed to help calm you down, help you get to sleep faster. Yeah, right. It didn't matter that I'd already been up for close to 48 hours, that I'd tried all the breathing exercises they'd taught us at the creek, or that I even slipped two of my baby L's. Note 6. Baby L's. Officially a pain reliever, but used by many military personnel as a sleep aid. End note. You're only supposed to take one, but I figured that was for lightweight wussies. I was me again, remember? I could handle it. And hey, I needed to sleep. I asked her, since there was nothing else to do or think about, if it was okay to talk about her. Who was she, really? How'd she end up in this isolated cabin in the middle of Cajun country? She didn't sound Cajun. She didn't even have a southern accent. And how did she know so much about pilot training without ever going through it herself? I was starting to get my suspicions, starting to piece together a rough outline of who she really was. Metz told me again that there would be plenty of time later for an episode of The View. Right now I needed my sleep and to check in with her at dawn. I felt the L's kick in between check and in. I was out by dawn. I slept hard. The sky was already light by the time I opened my eyes. I'd been dreaming about, what else? Zack. His moans were still echoing in my ears when I woke up. And then I looked down and realized they weren't dreams. There must have been at least 100 of them surrounding the tree. They were all reaching excitedly, all trying to climb over each other to get up to me. At least they couldn't ramp up. The ground wasn't solid enough. I didn't have the ammo to take all of them out, and since a firefight might also buy time for more to show up, I decided it was best to pack up my gear and execute my escape plan. You had planned for this? Not really planned, but they'd trained us for situations like this. It's a lot like jumping from an aircraft. Pick your approximate landing zone, tuck and roll, keep loose, and get up as quick as you can. The goal is to put some serious distance between you and your attackers. You take off running, jogging, or even speed walking. Yes, they actually told us to consider this as a low-impact alternative. The point is to get far enough away to give you time to plan your next move. According to my map, the I-10 was close enough for me to make a run for it, be spotted by a rescue chopper, and be lifted off before these stink bags would ever catch up. I got on the radio, reported my situation to Metz, and told her to signal SNR for an immediate pickup. She told me to be careful. I crouched, I jumped, and cracked my ankle on a submerged rock. I hit the water face down. Its chill was the only thing that kept me from blacking out from the pain. I came up spluttering, choking, and the first thing I saw was the whole swarm coming at me. Metz must have known something was up by the fact that I didn't report my safe landing. Maybe she asked me what had happened, though I don't remember. I just remember her yelling at me to get up and run. I tried putting weight on my ankle, but lightning shot up through my leg and spine. It could bear the weight, but I screamed so loud I'm sure she heard me through her cabin's window. "Get out of there," she was yelling. "Go!" I started limping, splashing away with upwards of 100 G's on my ass. It must have been comical, this frantic race of cripples. Metz yelled, "If you can stand on it, you can run on it. It's not a weight-bearing bone. You can do this." "But it hurts." I actually said that, with tears running down my face, with Zach behind me howling for his lunch. I reached the freeway, looming above the swamp like the ruins of a Roman aqueduct. Metz had been right about its relative safety. Only neither of us had counted on my injury or my undead tail. There was no immediate entrance, so I had to limp to one of the small adjoining roads that Metz had originally warned me to avoid. I could see why as I began to get close. Wrecked and rusting cars were piled up by the hundreds, and every 10th one had at least 1 G locked inside. They saw me and started to moan. The sound carried for miles in every direction. Metz shouted, "Don't worry about that now. Just get on the on-ramp and watch the fucking grabbers." Grabbers? The ones reaching through broken windows? On the open road, I at least had a chance of dodging them. But on the on-ramp, you're hemmed in on either side. That was the worst part by far, those few minutes trying to get up onto the freeway. I had to go in between the cars. My ankle wouldn't let me get on top of them. These rotting hands would reach out for me, grabbing my flight suit or my wrist. Every headshot cost me seconds that I didn't have. The steep incline was already slowing me down. My ankle was throbbing, my lungs were aching, and the swarm was now gaining on me fast. If it hadn't been for Metz. She was shouting at me the whole time, "Move your ass, you fucking bitch!" She was getting pretty raw by then. "Don't you dare quit! Don't you dare crap out on me!" She never let up, never gave me an inch. "What are you, some weak little victim?" At that point, I thought I was. I knew I could never make it. The exhaustion, the pain, more than anything, I think, the anger at fucking up so badly. I actually considered turning my pistol around, wanting to punish myself for, you know. And then Metz really hit me. She roared, "What are you, your fucking mother?" That did it. I hauled ass right up onto the interstate. I reported to Metz that I'd made it, then asked, "Now what the fuck do I do?" Her voice suddenly got very soft. She told me to look up. A black dot was heading at me from out of the morning sun. It was following the freeway and grew very quickly into the form of a UH-60. I let out a whoop and popped my signal flare. The first thing I saw when they winched me aboard was that it was a civilian chopper, not government search and rescue. The crew chief was a big Cajun with a thick goatee and wraparound sunglasses. He asked, "Where the hell you come from?" Sorry if I butchered the accent. I almost cried and punched him in his thigh-sized bicep. I laughed and said that they work fast. He shot me a look like I didn't know what I was talking about. It turned out later that this wasn't the rescue team, but just a routine air shuttle between Baton Rouge and Lafayette. I didn't know at that moment, and I didn't care. I reported to Metz that I got my pickup, that I was safe. I thanked her for everything she'd done for me, and so I wouldn't really start bawling, I tried to cover with a joke about finally getting that episode of The View. I never got a response. She sounds like a hell of a skywatcher. She was a hell of a woman. You said you had your suspicions by this point. No civilian, even a veteran skywatcher, could know so much about what goes into wearing those wings. She was just too savvy, too informed, the kind of baseline knowledge of someone who had to have gone through it herself. So she was a pilot. Definitely. Not Air Force, I would have known her, but maybe a squid or a jarhead. They'd lost as many pilots as the Air Force on resupply hops like mine, and 8 out of 10 were never accounted for. I'm sure that she must have run into a situation like mine, had to ditch, lost her crew, maybe even blamed herself for it like me. Somehow she managed to find that cabin and spent the rest of the war as one kick-ass skywatcher. That makes sense, doesn't it? There is an awkward pause. I search your face, waiting for more. What? They never found her? No. Or the cabin? No. And Honolulu never had any record of a skywatcher with the call sign Mets fan. You've done your homework. You probably also read my after-action report, right?
Yes.
And the psych evaluation they tacked on after my official debriefing?
Well,
it's bullshit, okay? So what if everything she'd told me was information I'd already been briefed on? So what if the psych team claim my radio was knocked out before I hit the mud? And so the fuck what if Mets is short for Metis, the mother of Athena, the Greek goddess with the stormy gray eyes? Oh, the shrinks had a ball with that one, especially when they discovered that my mother grew up in the Bronx.
And that remark she made about your mother?
Who the hell doesn't have mother issues? If Metz was a pilot, she was a natural gambler. She knew she had a good chance of scoring a hit with Mom. She knew the risk, took her shot. Look, if they thought I'd cracked up, why didn't I lose my flight status? Why did they let me have this job? Maybe she wasn't a pilot herself. Maybe she was married to one. Maybe she'd wanted to be one, but never made it as far as I did. Maybe she was just a scared, lonely voice that did what she could to help another scared, lonely voice from ending up like her. Who cares who she was or is? She was there when I needed her, and for the rest of my life, she'll always be with me.